I went to college in Illinois, medical school at the University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago, and then came out to the Northwest to do my residency in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington, and have stayed in Seattle and practiced ever since then. And initially I did obstetrics and gynecology, and then when my second son was born in 1989, I stopped doing obstetrics and have focused on gynecology only. So many, many of my patients are approaching menopause, in menopause, postmenopause, so this is something that I deal with every day professionally. And what I'd like to talk with you about today is some review of what we talked about yesterday, which is the medical consequences of estrogen deficiency, which is what menopause really consists of, and what the medical approach to dealing with those consequences is. As I mentioned yesterday, there are, you know, many sociological and philosophical and psychological aspects of menopause and how we are as middle-aged women in our society, but that is not my area of expertise, so we're not going to talk about the philosophy of it. We're going to presume that all of us want to live long, healthy lives and want to find out how we can make our quality of life as good as possible for as long as we live. I've put up here the names of a couple of books that I chose. This one is in the bookstore. And both of these books are written by women, and they talk about basically what I'm going to cover. They talk about hormone replacement therapy, but both of them cover many other aspects of managing and dealing with the symptoms and the consequences of menopause. A lot of dietary information and exercise information that will be helpful for you. And one other thing I want to mention before I get into the specifics of the slides is about the concept of relative risk, which is a statistical concept that has to do with how likely something is. If you say that the relative risk of a particular event, say having a heart attack, in the general population would be 1.0 is the baseline relative risk. Then if you want to add in an intervention, like say you lower your cholesterol level, what would your relative risk be if someone had a lower cholesterol? Then that risk would be, say, 0.75. That means a 25% lower risk of having a heart attack. So a relative risk of 1 point something, or 2 point, or whatever, above 1 would be an increased risk that whatever the intervention we're talking about would be related, and a relative risk of less than 1 would be a reduced risk. So let's go ahead and turn on the slides. Today what we're going to do is review a bit, could you pull the slides up, pull the lines down up there, I think that might go. We're going to review some of the information we talked about yesterday about the general consequences. We'll go in a little bit more detail to osteoporosis, and then, lights. Now there's an idea. I'm sorry, I'm pulling that thing against your feet.
Sat in the wrong place.
I thought maybe I better stand over here. And then we're going to talk about some real specifics about treatment, about different hormones.
We've got some more cord.
Oh, thank you.
There we go.
Let's see if we can get over the flowers.
You know what? I think that's going to work right there.
There we go.
Okay. That's good. So, in 1900, the average age of menopause was 51.4, and the average life expectancy was 50 years. So, menopause wasn't such a big issue back then. It didn't happen to very many women. Now, the average age of menopause is still 51.3 or 51.4 years, and the life expectancy is up to 80 years.
I have a question about that. It occurred to me yesterday. Hasn't the age of menarche been lowered?
A little bit. It hasn't changed very much.
But it hasn't affected the average age of menopause.
No, in fact, the general tendency is that women who start their periods earlier go longer, you know, have a later age of menopause, and women who start their periods later tend to stop earlier.
Oh, something.
Yeah, people who say, well, I started when I was 11, I'm sure I'm going to go through menopause quickly. Doesn't necessarily work that way. And there is a general trend to have menopause somewhere around the same time your mother did. So if you looked at the whole population, you said all these women had an average age of menopause at this age, and all these daughters would be somewhere close. But, you know, for you and your mother, it might not necessarily be the same.
Does having children increase the time?
So we're going to be spending more than a third of our lifetime, if we have the average life expectancy, in this postmenopausal time period. Part of this, you know, the increased life expectancy has to do with improved nutrition over how things were in 1900 and that sort of thing. You know, vaccinations, water supply being safer and that sort of thing, antibiotics, sort of things that we expect as part of modern life. But it also has to do with medical technology that can, you know, provide cardiac bypasses and angioplasties for people who have heart attacks and all other kinds of a very high-tech medical treatment that allows us to keep living longer and longer. And
we don't die in childbirth either.
Right, we don't die in childbirth, exactly. Exactly. So you know, there's an argument about, well, it's not natural to treat menopause. You know, menopause is a natural part of life. You know, well, so is having your teeth fall out and, you know, being nearsighted and not being able to see, or having cataracts when you're older. But we operate on cataracts and we go to the dentist and we get our teeth fixed. And, you know, I think this is another way in which we can intervene to allow these years to be healthy and happy. Menopause is defined as the end of menstruation, and usually we can't say that's absolutely happened until 1 year after the last period. Usually ovarian function has been declining for several years, and there's a period that some people call perimenopause, which is difficult for me to define medically. It's sort of after the fact you can say, aha, you were in perimenopause, and that's why your periods were wacky for a couple of years. There are obviously different perceptions among American women about menopause, and American women have different attitudes about menopause than women in other cultures do. But this is the way it is, and we, you know, we can't necessarily transport ourselves to Japan and have the same sort of attitudes about menopause as Japanese women do, for instance. Estrogen deficiency is really the medical consequence of ovarian function decline. There's a little knob on the projector. Yeah. Isn't that clear? Sorry. So the symptoms are basically these. The primary one is hot flashes and night sweats, sleep disturbance that we call vasomotor instability. Why the pathetic is that?
For some reason, it
doesn't want to hold.
Slide pops. And it has to do with the heat. Slide. It did the same slide did the same thing yesterday. Just like
urogenital atrophy is the medical term for thinning of the epithelium, the lining of the vagina and the bladder. And the vaginal lining tends to get thinner and smoother, so that, you know, when you're young, if you looked at a picture of the vagina in a cross section, you would see a lot of pleats in the walls, and that's what allows the vagina to expand for, as it's intended for childbirth, but also for intercourse. When estrogen levels decline, those pleats in the wall disappear, and the vagina becomes quite smooth, and it just doesn't have as much elasticity anymore. Also, it doesn't produce as much lubrication, sexual lubrication. And the bladder is also sensitive, and many women will develop of stress urinary incontinence or leaking urinary cough or sneeze, and that's related to estrogen as well. Many women that are going through menopause or are postmenopausal will report changes in mood, frequently depression or anxiety. Hard to know exactly how much that's related to estrogen, and it hasn't really been studied very well, but it's our experience, those of us who talk to many women in menopause, that these are fairly common complaints. There may be some cognitive changes in the sense of having trouble remembering, having trouble concentrating. Many of these symptoms are things that will happen especially around the transition, so within the few years around the transition to menopause. And frequently the hot flashes and night sweats will go away after usually a couple of years or so. The vaginal dryness and the urogenital changes tend to get worse as women get older because the dryness becomes more and more severe. The vagina can become smaller and smaller. Much of what we're going to talk about today are these long-term changes, and these are things that begin at the time of the menopausal transition, but do progress and get worse as we get older and older. And again, most of these vasomotor changes are right around the transition, and then the others as we get older. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday, that 6 months to 2 years is the typical time for the presence of hot flashes, although many women report having had hot flashes for years before they stopped having periods. The most common scenario would be to have hot flashes or night sweats right before or during your period, because that's the time in your natural cycle when your estrogen level is naturally at its lowest. So you may notice that in the years as you're approaching menopause, that those symptoms occur then, but the rest of the month you feel fine. Again, we talked about that. These are areas that I wish somebody would do some more research on to find out whether they really are specifically related to estrogen levels or whether they're somehow related to other things that are happening at middle age. Now, this is really the bottom line about the cause of death and what, how we can intervene in this way. The majority of women, by far the largest cause of death is heart disease, and this is mostly heart attacks and strokes. Many, many more deaths from this than from breast cancer. This is about 4%, so at least 10 times as many deaths are caused by heart disease as breast cancer. And even more, twice as many as from all other cancers. That would include primarily heart attacks or myocardial infarctions. Angina or chest pain is a symptom of coronary artery disease and is frequently a precursor to heart attacks. Stroke would be a cerebrovascular accident or a blood clot in the brain. And elevated cholesterol is a risk factor really for cardiovascular disease. This is a graphic depiction of osteoporosis. This is the same woman at age 50 and at age 75. And you can see what's happened to her spine. She's considerably shorter and her lower abdomen's kind of pooching out here. She looks like she's about the same weight, but her shape looks very different. And this is a painful condition. We'll come back to that a little bit later.
Excuse me, is the pain constant or the pain?
Frequently it's constant. Vertebral fractures, those are the fractures in the spine where the square-shaped vertebra collapses in the front, in this side of the vertebral body. And there's a 25% risk of that happening by age 50 and 50% risk by 75. Hip fractures are not themselves fatal, but are frequently associated with complications like pneumonia that develops when a woman is laid up in the hospital after her hip fracture surgery. Of course, the fracture requires an operation, and then the woman has to be in the hospital for a while, and many women will get pneumonia, and many die as a result of that. The other thing... Mm-hmm.
No,
Nelson?
Oh, go ahead and finish.
Oh, the other thing is that it's common to get a blood clot in the leg, which can then travel to the lungs as a pulmonary embolus, as that can happen as a complication of any fracture. In this situation, it's fairly common and can be the cause of death.
My question just had to do with the vertebral fractures.
Uh-huh.
Is that 25% risk in those who have already been diagnosed with osteoporosis, or how do we come up with
those things? Yes, those, that's people with osteoporosis. So not everybody who has osteoporosis will have a fracture, but half will have some sort of a fracture by the time they're that old. The other consequence of hip fractures is that many women are really never the same, never regain the same mobility that they had before. And it's a common scenario to see a woman who was in her 80s living at home independently, falls and breaks her hip, and never is able to go back home again. Goes from a hospital to an intermediate care to a nursing home, or is dependent on someone else. So this is a little bit of an old slide, so this is a low estimate, and some of my other slides have a higher estimate for the total cost to all of us of this sort of problem going on. Hormone replacement therapy is one way that we can deal with some of these long-term consequences. And there are benefits. Briefly, I could show you any number of slides about any number of research studies that have been done that show when you take women before treatment and after treatment, you see a significant reduction in the number of hot flashes in an 8-hour period based on the treatment with estrogen. And this could be done with any kind of estrogen. This is the estrogen patch, transdermal estradiol, that means it goes through the skin. Could be done with Premarin or Estrace or any other kind. They all work very well to get rid of hot flashes, and it really doesn't take very much for that sort of treatment. It is true that if you take estrogen to get rid of hot flashes, if you go off of it in a year or 6 months or 2 years, you will probably get those hot flashes back again. But somehow, it seems to be, the pull process seems to be worse around the time of the transition. So many women feel like they need it during the time that they're going through menopause, and a few years later, things are not quite so bad. These are different particular problems that women report with intercourse. This is the medical term for painful intercourse, a general term, dyspareunia. And these orange bars are the women who, before they started on any sort of treatment, and these are various doses of estrogen alone or estrogen with progesterone added. And this is just how many women were in each group in this particular study. And in every category, you can see that there's a dramatic reduction in those symptoms from using this treatment for, this is probably a 3-month study. It doesn't take very long to get improvement, although it does depend on how long you've been postmenopausal. So if you're 20 years postmenopausal and you're going on estrogen to improve your vaginal lubrication, it's going to take a little while to get it back to where it was before. The Nurses' Health Study has been a really important study for us to follow this group of women. I think it's 59,000 women that's been followed since 1976. For various parameters having to do with their health. They found when they looked at the data in 1985 that women who were using estrogens after menopause had a significant reduction down to half of the risk of coronary artery disease. So this is that relative risk of 0.5. That means that it's 50% reduced from the baseline, or 50% reduced from the women who didn't take any estrogen. If women were using the estrogen at the time, not just that they used it in the past, but they were on it at the time that they were, the questionnaire was done, they had a 70% reduction. And this was even after they adjusted for all these other factors, which themselves are risk factors for heart disease. They looked at the data again in 1986, and they found at that time that there were two different groups, basically those that had used unopposed estrogen, their reduction was 40%, And when in the women who use combined estrogen and progestin, which is a term that applies to synthetic forms of progesterone, which is our natural hormone, their reduction was almost 60%. They didn't find any reduction in the risk for stroke. Some articles or some researchers have found a reduction in stroke, but in this particular group, they didn't. Now, in the, I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to that. It's too dark now. In their most recent report of their mortality data that was published about 2 weeks ago, they found that the current hormone users had a relative risk of 0.63 of having died. So if you were on estrogens in that study, you were 40% less likely to have died of anything as the women who never took estrogen. After 10 years of being on estrogen, the relative risk was 0.8, so it was only 20% reduced, and that was because in this study they did find an increase in the risk of breast cancer. So there were no more deaths from breast cancer that to some degree canceled out the reduction in deaths from coronary artery disease. Didn't eliminate the benefit, but it reduced the benefit. And again, there was no significant change in the death rate from stroke. And the benefit in reduction of death disappeared after 5 years of stopping the hormones. So the women who were on it at the time had more of a benefit than the women who had used it for a while and then stopped. The benefit we think is related, probably about a third to a half of it is because of changes in cholesterol metabolism. HDL, which is the so-called good cholesterol, tends to go up. LDL tends to go down. In general, the HDL that we're looking for, if you know your HDL, and if it's above 60, you're in good shape, because that is associated with, in general, with the reduction in the risk of coronary artery disease. HDL, we want to be less than 130. And if you know your ratio, that is your total cholesterol over your HDL level, that ratio we want to be less than 4. So say if your total cholesterol was 200 and your HDL level was 50, that would give you a ratio of 4. And that's the lower the better as far as that ratio goes. There also appear to be direct effects on the cells on the inside of the arteries caused by the estrogen, and there are lower fibrinogen levels. And fibrinogen is one of the substances in our blood that causes blood clotting. So if we have less of that, hopefully we'll have fewer clots. And what causes coronary artery disease or heart attacks is plaques on the inside of the arteries, which are composed of cholesterol and fats, and then blood clot platelets and other blood clotting factors attached to those clots and cause a clog in the artery. Now, this is women who had already had a heart attack or a stroke who went on, and if they went on hormone replacement therapy after these events, they had about 50% reduction of having another heart attack. If they had had a heart attack in the past or hypertension in the past, they had a 50% reduction of having another heart attack and dying from it. So if a previous stroke, previous heart attack, about a 50% reduced risk of having another stroke and dying. So even if you already have heart disease, you can benefit from hormone replacement therapy. Now, we're back to osteoporosis. These are the rates of fractures, hip fractures with no estrogen. And you can see that the rate obviously increases significantly as we get older. If we had a group of 80-year-olds over here, it would be even higher than this. This is the lower forearm fracture here called the Colles fracture. And this frequently happens when a woman trips and falls, puts her hands out to brace herself and breaks these bones here in the forearms. So this is another very common fracture. And this is what happens when you go on estrogen in this particular study. So a rate somewhere around 5 reduced to about 2. Significant reduction here. And again, this was done on oral estrogen. This is from 1980. The studies have been repeated over and over and over again. And all the different kinds of estrogen, including the patch, are beneficial for reducing the risk of osteoporosis and fractures. This study demonstrates that these lines here are the women who took placebos. That is, they took only a blank pill and were followed for a number of years. As far as their bone mineral density, this would be in the fingers, the amount of bone in the fingers. In this pink line was the women who at the beginning of the study were lucky enough to get those pills that had estrogen in it, and they maintained their bone density quite nicely over this 10-year study. This group of women here started out without estrogen. Let's see, this one belongs to this line here. These started out without estrogen, but they crossed over in the trial at about 4 years and went on the estrogen off the placebo. And you can see they had some improvement in their bone density, and then they were able to maintain it. I'm not sure why there's a decline here at the end. But generally, this was a good maintenance of their bone density. Still isn't as good here as it would have been there, but it's better than
Linda, will
this.
You explain the left-hand column, 32 uh-huh. to 46?
Okay, this is actually milligrams per millimeter of bone. So it has to do with the exact measure of the density in the bone. That's just the units that the machine uses.
So what's typical of a young person, say a 25-year-old?
I don't know the number because this is not a number that we don't measure this in the fingers anymore. And everything that I do has to do with standard deviations and not numbers. So I'm sorry to say that I don't know what the number is, but it would be somewhere up in here, because these were women that started on this right at the time of menopause. So their normal bone mass would be up in this area.
Does it go down though, like from age 25 to 50?
Well, the peak bone mass is usually around 35. 30 or 30.
So it hasn't probably gone down a whole lot.
Right. It depends a lot. We're sort of talking about a big population of people here, so it should be up in this area or higher. This group, again, stayed off the estrogen on the placebo until about 6 years out, and then they went on estrogen and again had maintenance of their bone density at that level. So even if you started it down here, you would still get maintenance out here as opposed to this one, which is going to be down at this level.
How does that compare with people who are taking pretty good doses of calcium?
Yeah, calcium, I have a slide about that a little bit later. Calcium by itself, or calcium with exercise, is not enough. Does not provide as much maintenance of bone density as estrogen does.
But how does it do? Is it nicely between those on the placebo,
well,
or is it?
Most of the studies that have a placebo group, at least now, I'm not sure about 1991, have both the women in the placebo group and the women in the treatment group are taking a calcium supplement. Mm-hmm. So usually they have, even the placebo group has a calcium supplement. Mm-hmm. So you would hope that, you know, this lowest line would be women who didn't care a thing about it, didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And probably calcium would be a bit better. Mm-hmm. But it's not, there's no way that calcium by itself is going to have you back up here. If you are a person who is at risk for osteoporosis.
How much variability is there in the bone density achieved? You know, we were talking a little bit yesterday about the problem of young girls not wanting to drink mm-hmm. milk, which is mm-hmm. the easiest way to get your calcium. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a woman who's reached 40 or 50 and hasn't been a milk drinker or a calcium taker, I mean, are you going to start at a lot lower place on that scale? And so therefore you're in more danger?
My general answer would be yes. You kind of have to find out what your bones are like yourself, because there's a wide variability. And as I said yesterday, I have learned that I can't tell from looking at you whether you're somebody with osteoporosis and you're somebody who doesn't.
So if you're somebody who's drunk milk all your life, every meal, you're probably in pretty good shape.
Well, you would think that, but I have also seen women who've had a bone density testing done and have said that to me. Yeah. How did I get this? I've been drinking milk every day. And they're still are having problems with their bones. So there's more to it than just milk and calcium, unfortunately. It may have to do with periods of time in your life of not having periods, when your estrogen level was lower. Women who have a history of having had an eating disorder or were very athletic and didn't have periods for a long period of time.
Can lots have, of children?
Hmm?
Lots of children.
Well, being pregnant is a different story, because that doesn't deplete your estrogen level. So not having periods because you're pregnant is actually better for you.
That can deplete your bones. Like my mother had 6 pregnancies and she broke her hip when she was 50.
Uh-huh.
3 years after her hysterectomy.
Uh-huh. After not being on estrogen after the hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, she took estrogen.
Did she? Well.
I mean, she had a fall on ice, but most people 50 years old aren't going to break their hip if they fall on ice.
Exactly.
What was the old line that you lost a tooth for every child you had? There was some concept that pregnancy depleted the calcium in your system?
In your teeth, yeah. That's right.
I don't know that one. Mm-hmm. Because don't we take calcium when we're pregnant? Is that correct?
Yes, that's supposed to be for the baby.
Oh, okay. Taking it for the baby.
I also want you to know that there's emerging evidence that hormone replacement therapy appears to reduce the incidence of colon cancer. And the Nurses' Health study that I mentioned before also showed a decrease in the colon cancer incidence in the women in that study by, what did I say, 0.65. on the current users, so that was a 35% reduction. And it's so dark in here. I wanted to also talk about a recent study from the journal called Neurology on Alzheimer's disease, which was from the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging, where they followed 472 women for up to 16 years and compared whether or not they had taken hormone replacement therapy. And the relative risk for Alzheimer's disease for the users of estrogen was 0.46. So they had more than a 50% reduction in the risk of Alzheimer's disease if they had taken estrogen, if they were taking this. And this could potentially be very important if it's borne out in other studies, because there's nothing much we can do about Alzheimer's disease once you have it. So if there's a way you can reduce your risk of getting it by taking estrogen, that would be important. The risks we talked about in a little more detail yesterday, I'll try to go through this quickly so we can get to some other topics. Endometrial cancer is no question. It's related to unopposed estrogen. That means estrogen by itself increases the risk of endometrial cancer. That's cancer of the uterine lining, not the cervix, not the ovaries, but the inside of the uterus. And it is related to using a higher dose and using it continuously and for a longer period of time. Most of these cancers are well differentiated and minimally invasive, meaning they're fairly easy to treat by doing a hysterectomy, and do not typically turn out to be the kind of cancers that are widely metastatic and that women die from, but of course that can happen. And of course, once you get endometrial cancer, then you can't take estrogen anymore. So there's the end of your benefits. This is again to show that if you used estrogen by itself for a long period of time, for 15 years or more, and you're still doing it, you have a relative risk of 34. So 34 times the risk of getting endometrial cancer as someone who had never used it. If you use it for a shorter period of time and it was 15 years ago, you only have 6 times the risk. But this is still a substantial increase over the baseline risk. And endometrial cancer is actually a fairly common cancer. In fact, it's the most common gynecological cancer, more common than cervical cancer or ovarian cancer.
How do you test for it?
The test for that would be an endometrial biopsy or a DNC.
So they have to be symptoms first?
Usually bleeding. Bleeding is the primary symptom of this. And that's why, you know, we tend to really jump on any kind of abnormal bleeding and test with endometrial biopsy or DNC. The PEPI trial was a study that was done that followed women for 3 years on various combinations of estrogen and progesterone. And they found in that study, they did endometrial biopsies every year on the women in that study, and they found that they had a 10% per year incidence of endometrial hyperplasia, which is a precancerous condition that can lead to endometrial cancer if it's not treated. And their total was 30% of the women who were on the unopposed estrogen in that trial developed endometrial hyperplasia. They had, I think, 1 or 2 cases of cancer. And the reason that you might ask, why did they study this unopposed estrogen? We already know that it can cause cancer because this was a recent study. And they were doing it to compare the effect of the estrogen by itself with the estrogen progesterone combinations on the cholesterol values. But I don't think people are going to be doing studies anymore on unopposed estrogen, so I think they've proved it. When you add progesterone or a progestin in with the estrogen, you reduce this risk from 12% down to 2%, 30% down to 0% in this particular study. Breast cancer is something that we're all very concerned about. And even though the incidence is much lower than the incidence of heart disease, so we're much less likely to get breast cancer than we are to get heart disease, it still is obviously very, very important to all of us. There, I'm not going to go through these in detail today, but this is to point out that different studies have come up with different numbers. Some have shown no significant, now 7% increased risk is probably not enough even to be statistically significant. You know, that could be just chance, that much of a difference. 50% risk after 15 years here, 30% risk, more increased risk if there was a family history. Again, Nurses Health study previously showed a 40% increase, then they looked at it again, 32 to 41% increased risk. The most recent report from the Nurses Health study showed a 43% increased risk. That was after 10 years. After you've been taking it for 10 years, that was the increased risk. A recent study from Seattle looking only at women who were on the combined estrogen progestin treatment did not show an increased risk. Now, many of these previous studies were looking both at women who took estrogen by itself and women who took estrogen and progesterone, kind of lumped them together. So the researchers now are trying to separate them out so we can have a good idea about what the progesterone does. The Women's Health study followed 46,000 women for about 15 years, and they showed a 20% increase in breast cancer incidence in that study. This is just point out how different results from these different studies kind of add up to something that is not a very big increase here, but is slightly over 1, relative risk of 1 being if you didn't take any estrogen. I realize this is confusing, and that's the bottom line. It is confusing. I don't know what the answer is about breast cancer. I look at all these studies and I say, well, it's hard to tell. The Iowa Women's Health study looked at a number of these different incidences Breast cancer was increased in this population. Colon cancer was decreased. Hip fracture was decreased by about half. Coronary heart disease mortality was reduced. And total mortality was reduced by 22%. So women in this study who took estrogen were 22% less likely to die than the women who didn't take estrogen during the course of that study. And here's another way of looking at that same kind of information. Lives saved, if you took estrogen per 100,000, that should be 100,000 instead of whatever that number is right there. Between 50 and 75 by taking 0.625 milligrams a day of Premarin, this would be the most common dose, you would save 5,250 lives from heart disease. You would save 563 lives from deaths resulting from hip fractures mostly, and you would lose 18 lives from breast cancer. So you have to keep it in perspective what, you know, it's very a personal decision about what matters most to you, but these are the statistics.
It would be interesting to see that correlated with age, too, to see if that's over your postmenopausal period, or if there's the risk of heart disease is, say, greater from 55 to 65.
Well, the risk of the heart disease risk increases, continues to go up as you get older. And the fracture risk is actually much higher later than it is between 50 and 75. So the next 25 years after 75 would be an even higher risk then.
And what about breast cancer?
Breast cancer also continues to increase as you get older. This 1 in 8 figure that we hear, 1 in 8 or 1 in 9, that's the number of women, that's your risk of getting breast cancer by the time you're 85. Mm-hmm. So the risk, you know, at my age is much less than 1 in 8. Mm-hmm. But by the time I'm 85, that's the potential risk.
But having annual mammogram and breast check, if that would reduce that risk of, or catch it before.
Yes, those tests are not prevention.
No.
So doing those
no.
things doesn't help prevent it, but that promotes early detection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And since we don't really know how to prevent breast cancer yet, early detection is the best thing we have mm-hmm. to offer. So obviously annual mammograms are important. These are a couple of studies that are going on right now. The HERS study is comparing hormone replacement therapy with a placebo or a blank pill in women who already have had a heart attack or a stroke. And the Women's Health Initiative is a big study going on around the country where they're looking at the effect on heart disease and breast cancer. And they'll also be checking endometrial cancer and some other things. And this study is interesting because it contains a large component of women that are on dietary modification, low-fat diet. And so that will give us some good information. But we won't have any results from these until after the year 2000, maybe for 10 years from now. I'd like to go a little bit more into osteoporosis now, and then we'll get into some specifics, some more specifics about the estrogen types of estrogen treatment themselves. Osteoporosis is frequently not recognized until a fracture has occurred. People, you don't have pain from it until you have a fracture. So if you have pain in your hip and you think, gosh, I must have osteoporosis because my bones hurt, that's not what it is. Again, this is a big problem, costs a lot of money. A lot of women will have trouble with this. Estrogen therapy is the treatment of choice. Not appropriate for every woman, but in these circumstances, estrogen is the drug of choice. It works the best. This is normal bone. This is osteoporotic bone. Big, the supporting structure of the bone here. The thickness of the bone, the outer part of the bone, which is more solid if you looked at a picture of bone, is thinner, and then there's a lot of big holes and air spaces in the middle of the bone. Women tend to get shorter. The hump on the back of the spine appears because those vertebrae are collapsing.
women tend to have pain from this. Again, that's where the bones are collapsing there. These are the risk factors for osteoporosis. White women are at the highest risk. A family history is an important feature. Smaller women who have poor nutrition, low calcium intake, not much exercise, are also increased risk. These are some medical conditions that are associated with osteoporosis risk: hyperthyroidism or too much thyroid hormone, and some other conditions. Cigarette smoking is a big factor. Too much alcohol is a big factor. High caffeine. You know, the milk in your coffee doesn't count. Can't count that. The caffeine eliminates the calcium benefit from your lattes.
And that's why fiber, it's a high fiber diet is there. And I've always heard that a toasted cheese sandwich has a little benefit if it's whole wheat bread, because the fiber in the bread just pulls the calcium uh-huh. through your system.
Uh-huh. That's right. So you got to figure out the balance there somewhere. The bone, we can do measurements of bone mass, and this is very useful, I find, especially in women who are uncertain about whether they want to take hormone replacement therapy or not. We can test the bone density and find out whether things look good now, or if your bones are already starting to thin, we better think about hormones or some other kind of treatment. The kind of report, these reports, it's not like asking for a blood count, you get one number. You get this big, elaborate report that gives a comparison to age-matched means and comparison to premenopausal means, or mean would be the average. And this is the one that we really get, that's where we make the comparison with the T-score. This is what a bone density test looks like. You do it with your clothes on like this. This is the most common test that's being used, at least in this part of the country, also called DEXA, dual photon absorptiometry, X-ray, something like that. And they can also, usually in the places where I send patients, they get it both in the spine, the lower spine, and then in the hip. So usually they measure in two locations. Carol?
When do you have this done?
Well, that all depends. Some people are advocating that women, everyone should have it as a baseline. But this test usually costs about $300, so it's a pretty expensive test for a baseline. I wouldn't do it, I wouldn't recommend it on someone who was still menstruating, but if you have stopped having periods and are either have a strong family history of osteoporosis or can't make a decision about hormones, or want not to take hormones and want to be sure that that's a reasonable choice, I think that's a good time to do it. I think if you're going to go on hormone replacement therapy anyway, that it's probably not necessary to do it. It's always useful information, but it's so expensive I can't really advocate it as a screening test for everybody.
I was part of a UCLA study of postmenopausal and women who were not on estrogen, and they not only gave this one, this test about every half year,
uh-huh.
they also took one more frequently that was the wrist.
On the forearm?
Yeah, uh-huh. Forearm.
Mm-hmm. That's this one.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now this one is, this machine is smaller and less expensive, so some doctors have these in their offices to do, and you know, if obviously if it's in the doctor's office, she's gonna run the test more often. So you may have, if your doctor has this in their office, you may have this test done, you know, as a monitoring test to see how your treatment is going. I'm not terribly aggressive about testing myself, and I hate to do a lot of tests that are real expensive because it costs all of us. So I try to do it selectively, but other doctors are really good on this kind of testing. This is what the report looks like, and it's got numbers all over it. The graph is nice because it shows this is the normal range, the blue range, and this is where this person's result is, way down here. So this is bad. This is not a good result. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at, this one looks like it's reporting it in terms of percentage of age match normals or percentage of young adult. So this woman is 30, or I'm sorry, 63% of age matched normal on this particular scan.
And what do you recommend that one?
Well, that would be somebody, that, let me show you a second what the other numbers are. And this is a report of the, now this, hard to see where the dot is. Looks like this one's okay. This one is up here in the normal.
She's age 35, yeah.
Right, Jane Smith, age 35. So this is what happens to the bone mass over time. This is in standard deviations now. We have a whole new set of units here. Standard deviations from this peak bone mass of young normal adults. So a 35-year-old normal woman. And this is what happens over time in general. There are two scores on the bone density result. One is the Z-score, which shows the standard deviation above or below this mean value here. This is the age-matched mean, and then this is where this person was. Why they tell us that number, I don't know, because they don't want us to use that number. This is the number they want us to use, which is the standard deviation above or below the peak young adult bone mass. So standard deviation on these slides, which were produced by the by a manufacturer, showed that osteoporosis is defined as this area that is more than two standard deviations below this mean. If my lab, the lab I use, uses minus 2.5. So the exact numbers of milligrams per centimeter of bone mass, I don't know the numbers. But this is what we go by, is the standard deviations. If you are more than one standard deviation below, but not quite down to 2 or 2.5, we call that osteopenia. And less than 2 or 2.5 is considered osteoporosis. And some women are going to be up in here. I've had patients in their 60s have bone mass up above, plus in the plus standard deviation. So you can't tell by looking. There are a number of other things that are involved, and I didn't show you the slide about what all this means about bone building and bone. But what's going on in your bone? You think of your bones as something very static. This is the way they are. They're there forever. But in fact, there's a dynamic process going on in your bones. There are cells called osteoclasts that are eating away bone, and there are cells called osteoblasts, which are building up bone. And what happens when you don't have estrogen around and you get older is that the osteoclasts are outperforming the osteoblasts. So the balance is not right anymore. You're breaking down more bone than you're building up. And we think what estrogen does is it reduces the activity of the osteoclasts. So it reduces the breakdown of bone, and the osteoblasts are still working to build it up. One of the things that we can check now is to determine the rate of bone resorption, or resorption is that osteoclast activity of breaking up the bone and calcium leaving your body. So we can measure this thing called N-telopeptide. And this is a test called OsteoMark, or an NTX test. And this is a urine test that you would take your second morning urine and you drop it off in the lab, and then they will tell you how much of this N-telopeptide, which is a breakdown product of your bone, is in your urine. And unfortunately, it's a wide range that's normal and abnormal, but generally you can have an idea whether you are reabsorbing a lot of bone at this particular time. The bone density test, the X-ray, gives you a picture of what has happened to your bones for your whole life up till now. The time you were an athlete, you didn't have periods, and the time you ate a lot of calcium or whatever, up until now. This test can tell you what's happening right now. So this is sometimes useful for monitoring whether the amount of estrogen we're giving is enough, or the amount of Fosamax we're giving is enough, or whatever kind of treatment we're doing. These other tests are not clinically useful. Let's talk, I'm going to come back to the, there was an interesting slide I showed yesterday that I had made copies of, which I'll, we'll come back to in a minute, but let's go fairly quickly through the actual use of estrogen, the different, I want you to see the names of the different drugs. This is material that I use when I talk to doctors about how to prescribe hormone therapy. Obviously you won't remember all of it, but I want you to at least recognize the names. These are the things that we consider when we're talking about hormone therapy. How bad are the symptoms? What is the family history? What are the other problems like? These are women who shouldn't take estrogen, those who've had breast or uterine, meaning endometrial cancer. Obviously, if you're pregnant or you've had abnormal bleeding that has not been evaluated. And mostly women who've had thrombophlebitis or clotting problems shouldn't take it, although that depends on the situation. When we're talking about hormone therapy, we start with the estrogen. You can use oral, meaning you swallow a pill, vaginal estrogen in a cream, or transdermal, which would be a patch. The most common one and the one that the majority of studies has been done on is Premarin. Premarin is, in fact, made from the urine of pregnant horses. That's where they get the name, Premarin. And there are farms where, I mean, it's true, there are farms where they have these horses, and that's what they're there for, is to produce their urine in there. I think a lot of them are in Canada. And some people are very concerned about this for animal rights reasons and don't like to take Premarin for that reason. Premarin contains a number of different estrogens. This should actually say not much 17-beta-estradiol. This is the active estrogen in our body, the one we have the most of. So Premarin doesn't really contain very much of that. Most of the research that we have talked about, when I say research on estrogen, it has mostly been on Premarin over the last few years. You can't have an estrogen level when you're on Premarin to see if you're taking enough, because there isn't much of this in the drug. It still works. By the effect of the other estrogens.
Linda, can you measure the estrogen level in your body when you are still under 40?
When you're still
under 40?
Yeah.
You can.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
if it's...
Can you measure the estrogen level in your body when you're younger?
And
yes.
If it's low and you are under 40, can you start taking hormone therapy?
Yes, you can start hormone therapy at any time when you are menopausal. The average age of menopause is 51, as I said, but many women are becoming menopausal earlier.
Yeah, but this particular person, she's my daughter, she's not in menopause.
Uh-huh. She has a low estrogen level.
Well, she may. Yes.
Oh.
Because she has a health problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if her hormone is low, in order to avoid osteoporosis later on, mm-hmm. You know, she may start taking.
Yes, that would be an unusual situation, but that's worth checking out to see whether she has any signs of that. The most common dose is 0.625, and that's that maroon pill you've probably seen. Now they finally have put the estrogen and the progesterone together in one pill, which is a great convenience. Prempro and Premphase. Esterase is probably the next most common estrogen product. This is the same as 17-beta-estradiol that's active in our bodies. It comes in three dosages, and the pills can be broken in half, so that if one dose isn't quite right for you but the next dose is too much, these pills you can break in half and you can titrate the dose for an individual easier with this. The Premarin you can't cut up like that. And you can monitor with the level of estrogen in the body. This mastalgia means breast pain. Sometimes this pure estrogen is a little more likely to cause breast tenderness. And the half-life of this drug is a little shorter than Premarin, so some women do better when they take it twice a day rather than just once a day. This is the estrogen patch, which comes in several different brands. This one bypasses metabolism in the liver because it just goes right through your skin, but that may reduce the cholesterol benefit that we talked about before in terms of cardiovascular disease, because that's where the cholesterol is manufactured in your bodies and the liver. Comes in several different dosage strengths. Sometimes it's irritating to the skin.
How would you know it says that it's good for people who can't orally absorb? How do you know whether you
can? That would be someone who takes estrogen and doesn't get good relief of their symptoms and takes more and still doesn't get relief of symptoms. So some people just don't seem to do well with the pills for one reason. The progesterone is important as part of this treatment because it eliminates the risk of the endometrial hyperplasia and endometrial cancer if you give enough of it. Most patients do fine with it. It has a very bad reputation as being the part of hormone replacement therapy that women just hate. And some women do hate it, but most women do fine with it. Adding the progesterone doesn't reduce the cardiac benefits of the estrogen, so it's important to be in there. And if you've had your uterus out, you don't need it. These are just the names of some of the ones that are available. When you take it in cycles, meaning for some number of days per month, usually 12 to 14 days, then that will provide protection for the endometrium. It usually results in a period, withdrawal bleedings, what we euphemistically call having a menstrual period. You have to take at least, it would be normal to take 10 days of your course of progesterone before you start to have bleeding. The other option with progesterone is to take a smaller amount of it, but to take it every single day. And this results in endometrial atrophy, meaning that the endometrial lining is very thin. And on this regimen, then you don't have any bleeding at all, except in the first 4 to 6 months when your body's getting adjusted to it, there may be any sort of unpredictable bleeding. Usually goes away after 6 months. I find that this works best in women who already have not been having periods for a long time. So that my experience in using this continuous method in women who've been having periods but became menopausal is that when you start in right on this, there's a lot of irregular bleeding that's really disconcerting.
Is there any risk to the atrophy?
No, it's perfectly fine. Yeah, some people feel like, well, isn't it stuff building up in there? Shouldn't it come out? But it isn't building up, it just is very thin. Provera is the most common one, also called Cycrin. And this 10 milligrams for 12 to 14 days a month eliminates endometrial hyperplasia. If you use 5 milligrams a day, people tolerate it better. It's slightly less effective, but it's still good enough for the FDA, for the studies. And they approve Cremfase, which is the one that contains the progesterone in the same pill with the estrogen. So that combination loses 5 milligrams a day for those 14 days. There can be side effects associated with this, and frequently, Kelsey?
Well, I was just going to ask if the side effects tend to decrease over time like they do with birth control.
Yes, they do, most of them. And, of course, there can be side effects from the estrogen as well. I'm kind of minimizing that because I think that, you know, for most women we can adjust the dosage, we can change to a different type, and usually we can figure out a way. So if you've tried one type of hormone, tried Premarin and didn't like it, then you don't necessarily have to say, oh, I can't take that stuff, because there are a lot of other options, if you think it's appropriate. Agestin is another kind of progesterone. It's a little stronger, so it works well for women who are having irregular bleeding problems. Unfortunately, it doesn't come in a small enough dose to be used in that continuous format. This is a so-called natural hormone, oral micronized hormone. It is possible to get estrogen made in this way, this natural form, as well as the progesterone.
Is this available by prescription?
It is available by prescription. Certain, there, not every pharmacy will have it because they make it up themselves in the pharmacy. The PEPI trial that I mentioned briefly earlier, in that study over 3 years, they found that the women who took this kind of progesterone as opposed to Provera had better results in terms of their cholesterol. And some women just like this, like the idea of it because it's more natural. It has not, other than that trial, it really has not been studied very well. And this is just in terms of the decision making between using the cycling or using the continuous method.
Can you tell us which one would really be the best one?
Well, neither one is the best. I mean, both are good in terms of long-term benefits, and it just, you know, depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. They're both safe, and they're both effective.
So with the cyclic, your menstruation continues, right?
Yes. Now, most women would continue to have periods for a while. But eventually, say you started it when you were 50 on the cyclic method, by the time you were 60, probably, you wouldn't be having a period anymore. Mm-hmm. But it does go on for a while. So somebody who hasn't had periods for years and goes on estrogen because she has osteoporosis or for other reasons wants to go on it, would probably do best on this method. Because, you know, why would you want to start up having periods again? You might have irregular bleeding at first on this, but a lot of women don't. Some women never have any bleeding when they start on. When you're taking, the thing that's important about the progesterone in protecting your uterus, now remember, all the benefits we talked about, heart, bones, and the symptoms are all related to the estrogen. The only reason the progesterone is in here is to keep from getting cancer in the uterus. And the way that you prevent that is by the presence of the progesterone, not by the absence of the estrogen. So the old-fashioned method was to take the estrogen from day 1 through 25 of the calendar month and skip it for the last 5 days, and then take the progesterone from day 16 through 25. That was a very tried and true method. But that isn't really, it isn't necessary to skip it, and many women get symptoms in those days that they're off the estrogen. They'll get the hot flashes back. So what's important, the estrogen you can take every day. The important part is the addition of the progesterone for 12 to 14 days. And then the continuous method, you have it every day.
So can you do the progesterone again by the calendar, the 1st through the 14th of every month?
Yeah.
Rather than...
What I usually do is do, if I'm doing separate pills of estrogen and progesterone, I usually have patients do the progesterone from the 1st through the 12th. Of the calendar month, because it's easier to remember. If you do the prim phase where it's all in one pill, it's on there for you, and it's 14 days. There are other options of how you can reduce side effects from this. Some people have advocated adding testosterone, which I haven't been impressed it makes a huge difference in my patients. This is what should be done in terms of follow-up. I'm sorry, I'm running way over, and I have even another carousel slide. So if you need to leave, just get up and leave, and I'll just keep talking. I think it's important for women to be followed up frequently when they first start on hormones, or if your doctor gives you a prescription and says, see you next year, that's not good enough. Unless you do perfectly well on it, but you really should be followed. I like to have patients keep a calendar, which we give away in the office that allows them to keep track of when they have been bleeding in case it's abnormal. Should have an exam every year, a breast exam, a pelvic exam, and a pap smear, and a mammogram every year. And the endometrial biopsy or the BNC should be done in women who simply cannot take progesterone, and there are some women. If you're monitoring estrogen levels, it should be more than 60. To prevent bone loss. I don't usually do this routinely. You can also measure in the vagina for the effect of the estrogen. And this is the urine test we were talking about for measuring bone.
How do you measure anything in the vagina?
It's like a pap smear, only you just take it from the vaginal wall. Okay. Shaw, do you want me to keep going? I have a few more slides.
Okay. Do you have 11:45?
Right now?
No, I'm going to 40.
Oh, okay.
Do you need some light?
I'm going first.
It's a buffet.
It's Narnia.
So you join the lines with me.
So is it just one question?
Just go get the removed.
Right.
Kind of like breakfast.
Today, Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
Wonderful.
Feel like those nursing homes, I'm gonna say.
Somebody wanna turn on, let's see, plug in and turn on that overhead, I can be looking at that while I'm trying to get this.
I don't wanna put in on your cut, are you finished?
No.
You're not finished yet?
No, I'm quite.
Oh, you want to, I wanted to make an announcement.
Well, make an announcement, she's changing carousels.
Go ahead, changing, all right. We are doing some filming, the Tate Ministry is doing some filming for videotape, and we need your, we need you as extras, and if you would, just, we only need you for about 1 minute, if you would, when you're finished, to come over to the Creekside room, sit in chairs.
He already told us that.
Okay, and you're gonna sit there like you're sleeping?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're really bored, I mean, if you're knitting, knit, you're not, there's not gonna be any voices, or really not, we're not picking up any voices on the tape.
If you start bleeding before day 10, when you're on one of these regimens where you take 12 to 14 days, that's too soon. And if you've been taking the combined one for more than 6 months and you have bleeding, that's abnormal. So that's what should be evaluated. This is what I tell doctors, is to know what these drugs look like and to ask patients specifically how they're taking it, because there's a lot of error that can happen because the pharmacy wrote the wrong thing or whatever. So it's important to know that you
color. Pay attention to your color.
Right, exactly. Side effects, these are the most common, but there are many others, and most women don't have any. And a lot of these things, again, will happen at the beginning and will go away as you get used to it. Other things that are important, of course, besides hormones, would be lifestyle factors in terms of your overall long-term health, having to do with both your cardiovascular risk and your bone risk. Smoking is very bad for everyone. So if you smoke, you have to stop. Calcium is important, exercise and vaginal lubricants, I'm going to show you at the end. Calcium is recommended at 1,500 milligrams a day for postmenopausal women. This is a new recommendation from the RDA, used to be 800, but now it's at 1,500 for postmenopausal women.
Is that with or without estrogen? Sometimes I see a difference with either. Sometimes they say less if you're taking estrogen.
Yeah. Well, you could probably get away with 1,200, 1,000 or 1,200 if you're on estrogen. But if you're not taking,
can you overdo with your calcium intake?
Well, if you're prone to kidney stones, I'll take too much.
Because I take 1,500 milligrams plus milk and yogurt and. Mm-hmm. Are there vegetables that contain mm-hmm. calcium? Mm-hmm. Is it too much?
Probably not. I'll show you, I have an overhead with some various calcium contents in foods. The thing to know about the calcium is this is elemental calcium, the calcium itself. When you look at the label of Tums or Caltrate or any of those products, it's going to give you the milligram dose that's in the product. So you have to turn over the back and read the fine print of how much elemental calcium is in it. Okay.
Are you suggesting that adolescents should be taking calcium supplements?
I think adolescents should be drinking milk. They should be drinking more milk. But if they won't, then I think they should take calcium.
You wouldn't. It looks like that from that slide. You don't recommend that even adults premenopausal would increase their. Consumption of calcium,
well, you know,
as a protective measure.
It's pretty unusual for adult women to get 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day. That's three servings, three cups of milk. That's a lot of dietary calcium. I mean, we should, but most of us don't.
Okay.
again, calcium carbonate. When it comes to Tums, it's about 4 or 5 a day. Calcium by itself is not enough. This is what happens to bone mineral content with various doses of calcium over time. Okay, so this is even with the high dose, it still doesn't work as well as the estrogen along with it. Exercise is obviously important, and what we're talking about here is weight-bearing exercise. That means where your muscles work against your bones, because the muscles pulling on the bones is what causes that bone formation to happen. And things that involve that, you know, being upright and standing, you know, having to support your body weight are more valuable. We don't know for sure, although probably walking is good. Swimming is a great aerobic exercise, but does not do much for your bones because you're not supporting your body weight. So in terms of aerobic benefit for protecting your heart, obviously exercise is important. And you need probably a minimum of 20 minutes a day, 3 times a week, or maybe 4 or 5 times a week. And if you need some motivation to get exercising, I might recommend that you look at Oprah's book on Make the Connection, I think it's called. Oprah Winfrey's book about her personal trainer and getting exercise, very motivating.
So you don't think that walking is necessarily
good? I think walking is not as good as running. Of course, there are other drawbacks to running. But I think that if walking is the thing that fits in your life, then by all means do it. That's it. Women who have osteoporosis can do these other things. This is prevention of falls is important because, you know, if you're thinking about your grandmother, your mother, living in the same house that she's lived in for 40 years with little throw rugs and a lot of steps and that sort of thing. This is a problem for women who are losing their mobility and their balance. And you want to try to change the environment so there's fewer opportunities for that to happen. Pharmacological therapy. I don't have any slides specifically about the new treatments. Actually, this I do. Calcitonin is an older treatment for osteoporosis. It's now available in a nasal spray.
Yeah, that's the test I was on.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
enhances the, reduces bone loss. It's not as, again, that still doesn't work as well as estrogen does, but for women who can't take estrogen, that may be useful. The newest thing is called Fosamax.
Yeah.
And this is a drug that gets incorporated into the bone and strengthens the bone, so it increases the bone thickness and reduces the fracture incidence. It is unclear whether the bone that is made by Fosamax, which actually has the drug in it incorporated into the bone, will be as strong as natural bone would be. You know, it's been studied for years before they released it, but it hasn't been studied for 25 years, so we don't really know for sure. Currently, Fosamax is recommended for women who have osteoporosis now in a 10 milligram a day dose. When you take that, you have to take it first thing in the morning on an empty stomach, and you have to stay upright for 30 minutes after you swallow it. They're coming out with the 5 milligram dose, which is going to be recommended for prevention of osteoporosis.
And is it true if you stop taking it, then the effect goes away?
Yes. Yeah, after a long time. The effect of the Fosamax is to increase bone density by somewhere around 5 or 10%. And it's so new that we don't have a huge amount of information about it yet. Vitamin E can be useful for hot flashes, night sweats, in this sort of dosage. And I put this in here, I obviously didn't make this slide, but one of the things that's important is that continuing to be sexually active is one of the things that helps to keep the vagina elastic and moist, so that even women who have never taken estrogen at all in their 80s can have comfortable intercourse because they've been doing it all those years. So if you can and it's comfortable, then keep doing it because that makes it a continuing possibility. If you need an extra lubricant with intercourse, which may happen for women who are on estrogen or not, these are the ones. KY jelly, for some reason, has a great reputation, but doesn't work very well. It's very sticky. These are, have weird names, but really are much more natural, like natural education.
Those are real names?
Yeah, I have some samples, I'm sure. Astroglide, you can buy this at Costco. They actually, I saw in Costco, they had a big jug and then they had travel packs. So you can buy this in Bartels or, you know, Payless or any of those kind of drugstores. These moisturizers are things that you use not with intercourse, but on a regular basis. And I have not been impressed that they work all that well. I think that's the last slide. So let me show you this. Oh, one more thing to show here. Wouldn't that make sense to put the switch in the front?
Let me show this first, and then we'll go back to this other thing. I'm going to take that with you.
This is the calcium.
See that? Linda, what would you be using a vaginal moisturizer for if you were not having sex?
You wouldn't use a moisturizer unless... Oh, you would use it on a regular basis to increase the moisture in the vagina for when you do have sex. But you don't use it at the time. So these lubricants are things that you would use with your sexual activity.
But if you weren't sexually active, that wouldn't be an issue that you would necessarily take.
Not an issue at all. I'm not sure where the... Most of the milk products, you actually, when you have skim milk, you get better, you get more calcium per serving in skim than you do in regular milk.
What's the difference between skim and non-fat? Just how you spell it?
And yogurt, because it's more concentrated, you get more. So a cup of yogurt is better than a cup of milk.
Yeah.
In terms of calcium. And it looks like the only other thing on there that has a substantial amount is
sardines.
Sardines.
Woo!
Which probably have some essential fatty acids in it.
There's some
too.
Bones in there. Bones in the
cat. That's right. Probably why it has so much calcium.
On the left column is calcium.
If you'd like to look at this, you're welcome to look at it later. I wanted to put this other slide up here. This is the one that we talked about a little bit yesterday about how to decide, determining whether in your particular situation, if you have risk factors that would lead you towards either taking hormone replacement therapy or not taking it. And I did make copies of this for you so that you can take a look at it. What I didn't put on here, maybe I'll pass these out. If you're interested in putting on this the citation from the journal article, just in case you happen to end up taking this into your doctor and saying, in case your doctor hasn't seen this, so if you wanted to write down where it came from. And I have up here also some samples. That you can take a look at on your way out. These are some various products.
Are there foods that have natural estrogen in them?
That's a good question. Soy products tend to contain natural estrogens, phytoestrogens, or plant estrogens. Wild yams contain phytoestrogens, and that's where they get that's the source of those natural hormones I was talking about. And in fact, and ginseng also has some estrogen qualities, and you will find that described probably in a book like this about natural medicine.
What's the difference between a wild yam and any other yam?
Yeah, I don't know. It's not the same as a yam you buy at a drugstore.
You
have to
go.
Oh,
so can you buy?
I don't think you can buy the yams.
You have to go search it.
I don't think so. It is, you know, you can go in the health food store and buy creams that you put on your skin. that have progesterone in them and estrogen. And a lot of women have told me that they've gotten relief of their hot flashes and menopausal symptoms from that. And the problem is that there's no data.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been lots of studies, you can see, of the various forms of estrogen treatment, but these natural products, although it sounds great, oh, it's natural, it came from plants, but it hasn't been studied. So I'm not very comfortable with recommending that.